Madison Cunningham, welcome to Roots Radio.
Thanks for having me.
A real treat to meet you. Told you that I was a fan of the album and the other music as well. But Who Are You Now is a real statement. But let me first welcome you to Nashville and ask if you've had much history here.
I came here. My first introduction to Nashville actually was playing at the Ryman opening for a band called the Punch Brothers, which I know many people know and love, especially around here. So that I felt pretty fortunate that was my, that was like the floodgates for me for this town, which led me to, you know, seeing, my first impression was the, what do you call that strip where it's like a ton of bars and everyone's playing at once?
Lower Broadway.
Yes, the Lower Broadway. That was the first thing that I, you know, kind of took in of Nashville, and I was, you know, it was very distasteful to me. I didn't want to hear, you know, 10,000 different chords playing at once. So I, anyway, that was, but the Grand Ole Opry and the history of it was incredible to take in and to play in a room like that. And then since then I've been coming back, and it's honestly just like, I'm starting to really like Nashville a lot.
That Punch Brothers Ryman show, I'm thinking, was shy of 2 years ago. Can you sum up a little bit about where you were then in terms of your journey, your confidence, your aspirations, and how that's unfolded in the past 2 years? Would you say it's like hit the hyperdrive kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's felt very nonstop since that sort of happened, because I was in the fray of writing the record, and I was maybe 3 weeks out from recording it when I was playing at the Ryman.
How
so
about that?
I was playing a lot of the songs and trying them out before I went to record them. And the Punch Brothers honestly were my first tour ever. And so that was like, I mean, to be in the presence of someone like Thiele and, you know, Chris Eldridge and Noam Bukilny and Paul Cohort, and the list goes on and on. It's like, they're just so, they're probably the best at their instruments that you can possibly be. And it was like wonderfully intimidating to me, because I hadn't practiced so hard in my life, because I just wanted to, I don't know, you know, do it right and make them proud, or, you know, make them not regret that they asked me out. I think I was 20. I was maybe almost 21, I think, or almost 22, isn't it? Which was not that long ago. But
green. You felt green.
We'll say that.
Yeah. It came off very well. Yeah, it was a wonderful performance. And, you know, to stand there solo at the Ryman is an amazing accomplishment.
Thanks.
How did you come to know those guys, whether it was your fandom and or the connection that led you to be touring with them? They've championed you. Chris Thiele has championed you.
Yeah, totally. We share management. And right when I had signed with my manager, the first thing that he kind of put on my desk for me to do was to be the duet partner with Chris Thiele on his radio show that he had just inherited. And I was freaking out. I was so excited. And that also was one of the hardest things I'd ever done up until that point. And then since that first time that I joined him in 2017, I did the show 22 more times and then went on the road with them. And he's just been, you know, I feel like he understands me as a person and has reached out in an incredibly generous way that was above just being like, hey, cool, we're an acquaintance. It felt like he cared about, you know, the music and me, and that's a special, you know, a special thing to feel that you have sort of a comrade like that in a really, you know, in the big pool that is the industry. So it was awesome.
Well, you have a couple things in common. One is you're both from Southern California, and two, you both make, you both work in a folk idiom at sort of the outer cosmic edges of it. I imagine you probably felt some kinship there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, inspiration as well to, you know, watch him do it so professionally, but extremely, like, it gave me new fire to continue, and I think where I often feel led, but also he executes it so perfect, I mean, so well. So it you know, was encouraging to me.
Well, tell me a bit about the California scene. Your bio is quite brief, so I know Orange County, which is a a place that people describe as, you know, if you haven't been there, I don't know what it is or what the ground looks like or who's there. I know it's got a lot of wealth. It's conservative politically, but that's about it. So what's your Orange County and what do you think you carried away or how did it shape you?
That was probably the Orange County that I understood when I became an adult. But as a kid, it was, there was a big beach culture there that I never really fit into, but that, I mean, it's like you walk into a coffee shop or a restaurant and there's definitely people like barefoot and in shorts, you know, fresh off the beach. And, it's a lot of that culture and bleach blonde girls. And I always felt, I guess different. I don't love the beach, actually. I don't know. Fun fact for you. But yeah, I guess what I should say about Orange County is it felt like a very innocent bubble. All of my friends, I still am friends with today. I'm one of five girls. We all grew up there. And there's really pleasant memories associated with Orange County. It's clean, but I'm not necessarily drawn to that. I live in LA now and I love the grit of it and the art there. And that's what, I don't know, it can bring a lot out of you. In Orange County, just a little more like you're going to settle down and start a family and maybe never stop.
Right.
That was a very long answer to your short question. That's my impression of it. And also, there's not really much of a music scene in Orange County. I had a couple friends who I would meet up with and we would just kind of mess around and write things and just jam or whatever. But other than that, like, I tried so hard to get just one little gig at a coffee shop and they never returned, you know, my emails. So I was like, I didn't feel like there was really a place for me to continue on in music there, unless I was just going to keep commuting from LA to coming back.
Yeah. I read something about you being involved in church music and your family being involved in church music. Tell me about
that. That's right. Yeah. My dad is still a pastor at a church in Orange County. And he's a worship leader there. And so I, came up with him, singing there when I was like 12 to probably 17. And it was a wonderful time. It really was. It was just like, you know, there was nothing really pressing, but in a lot of ways I was able to just make music, with him and with people I had a lot of friends in the band too. So, it was a wonderful introduction to what it was like to perform in front of people, and it was safe too because I knew the people there loved me.
Yeah.
So it was, you know, that was a nice net to kind of fall on.
Was that the world we've heard called praise and worship music, or not? Am I way off base?
It was totally like that. But I was also writing my own songs that wasn't, I guess, under that category.
Did you get to perform your own stuff in that venue?
They sometimes they would let me perform one of my special songs, but it wasn't often.
I'm sort of getting at that because that world of music is a realm that sort of says the same thing many different ways over and over again. And I can imagine that somebody that's got something to say as a songwriter, that would be a real chafe and challenge. And like, I cannot wait to tell a different story with song and lyrics, right?
I look at it like it was an instrument, I think, to also make me eager and I think to say something, which was, I don't know. I'm thankful for it. I don't resent it in any way. I really enjoyed it.
You have the song in My Head on the record. And there are some moments that feel like they come from life, like you graduating in the class of 14, and the seven-person family in the five-seater van.
Yeah.
I mean, how much of that is you?
That's all true. Yeah. I my dad had this like Toyota, really ugly tan minivan, and it had five seats in it. My parents kept getting pregnant, having more kids, and he just couldn't part with this van because he had had it for almost 10 years, and it was all paid off, but like it was really smooth to drive is what he said. And there were seven of us kind of cramming in it for a little while, and finally he was like, okay, we can't do this anymore. I've got to get rid of it. But we called it the man van.
So pick up the story with post-graduation and you now writing songs and probably gotten pretty good on the guitar. And what did you want to do, and how did that play out?
I really only dreamt of doing what I'm able to do now, or what I am doing now. I wanted to get outside of my bubble and play and get good at that. Because I'd spent a lot of time practicing and, you know, writing songs. But I just knew there was so much more to... I was so scared to get in front of a crowd that was, you know, that had anything to do with the music industry. It felt incredibly horrifying and scary. And I feel like gotten over that for sure. But repetition is your best friend in that sense. And, yeah... So after high school, actually, right when I was graduating high school, I had already made a full-length record with a guy named Tyler Chester, who produced Who Are You Now, yeah. And has produced everything for me since. So that was a great catapult for me. But I also just thought, like, you know, I got to work with Tyler, and that was a dream for me at that point. I was 17. But I thought, like, he's, you know, it's just going to be a one-time thing. We're going to pay him, and... you know, he's going to do his own thing because he's great, and I'm just going to figure it out in Orange County, maybe never go anywhere. And then he called me probably 5 or 6 months later, and after we put the record out in 2014, and he was like, let's make another record. I want to help you. Let's do whatever it takes. And so that's how my second EP, or my first EP, I should say, came out. And yeah, that was, I'll never forget that. That was a really big moment in my life, I think, was him just kind of coming back for me in the sense of, like, I believe in something that you have, and I want to help. And I, you know, hadn't really felt that before. That's so great. That was pretty special.
When you alluded to practicing, you made a guitar player's left hand
with
a complicated chord on the fretboard. And so I could imagine a lengthy interview just about the guitar, because I'm a guitar player and a guitar freak and love the, you know, the range of things that have been done and yet are yet to be done on this instrument. Just staggers me that there's still... after, you know, 100 plus years of this instrument, you can walk into a room and see somebody do something utterly individual on it. So yeah. Tell me how you were introduced to, especially the fact that you're focused on the electric guitar. I know it's not exclusive, but your electric guitar playing is, I think, part and parcel of now how I hear your music and you embrace the textures of it. But talk about the practicing and why, your relationship with it.
Yeah, I never really went to school for it, and never really had lessons. For me, it was just a mode of working through stuff. But it was also, I just was so entertained by guitar and different tunings. And then, you know, I started on acoustic and then went to electric, and that just was mind-blowing for me because there was so many possibilities opened up. And I just did a lot of sitting in my room and making mistakes and calling them chords, you know, and that's still what I do. I like to just mess around because it's my happy place. But yeah, I guess I wasn't like just sitting around practicing pentatonics all day. It wasn't that. It was just like I wanted to practice melody and feel.
So I know you fell hard for Joni Mitchell. Doesn't surprise me at all. And she's somebody that does use the sophisticated vocabulary of chords. And so tell me about discovering both her as a lyricist, a singer, and a musician.
Yeah. I came to her later. I was definitely in my late teens. That sounds funny. Late teens is not that old. But but later, relative to most people that, you know, most people's parents, I feel like just have, you know, played it around the house, and that's how people learned about Joni, in my generation at least. And but I had a guitar player friend. He's sort of like an uncle to me, named Danny Donnelly, and he was teaching me open tunings, and so I was way into it and loved it and started writing songs that way. And I think he purposely waited to show me Joni because he wanted me to find my own thing in, you know, in the tunings he was showing me. And then he unleashed her on me, and I was like, oh, that's how you play in different tunings, and that's how you write a song. And, you know, like, it was, she just blew my mind. And I think the first song I listened to was Yellow Taxi, and then I listened to Help Me, and then got way into Court and Spark, and then Blue, and yeah, that was a good day. I had someone say, I'm really jealous that you get to listen to Joni Mitchell for the first time, which was, yeah, it was an incredible moment for sure.
You seem to have picked up on a sort of approach to songwriting that's she's one exemplar of, which is to say that songs don't have to have verses and choruses in an order. There's a kind of freer form. Because if you'd been coming up in Nashville, you know, I think a lot of the rigidity would have set in about what's appropriate and proper and what makes the mechanics of a song structurally sound or something. But you're free of that.
I do believe, I mean, some people might disagree with me, but I do believe it's because I didn't go to school and I don't have theory under my belt, and it's not because I didn't try to learn it. It's because I just didn't really understand it. Like the hearing side of it just made more sense than reading anything about it and knowing exactly what I was playing. And I guess I find freedom in just constantly being lost. Like I know the numbering system, of, you know, the chord family or whatever. But I don't, when I write songs, I just, it's all about the feeling or a guitar riff or a lyric that pops out, and those things guide the way, however they want to pan out. So I never really have like a, you should do this or you shouldn't do this. Yeah. Although my instincts do tell me those things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so I let that happen.
And in your guitar playing, the way you treat sort of solos, their leads are not really solos, but you do really, you know, like to let the instrument step forward.
Yeah, they're all pretty particularly written out. Like when I'm,
I mean, they are.
The way we recorded was live. So everything that you hear on the record was all very, very premeditated and written, and that's kind of, I guess, how I work. Like I can I arrange everything by, you know, with the guitar, so that each section is sort of kind of marked by it, and the leads are all kind of, or the solos or whatever you call it, are all usually pretty planned, except for maybe a few moments where I will go outside of it and just follow something else in the moment. But yeah, for recording, for the most part, everything is like just kind of locked and set in stone before we go in. And at least on my end, I work all of that out.
That's good to know, actually.
Yeah.
Can you tell me more about the song Plain Letters? It's probably my favorite on the record.
Oh, really?
I adore Plain Letters. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Yeah. I was, I think it was last summer. I read The Bell Jar by Sylvia Plath. Mm. And I just was moved by her story, and I mean, you know how it ends. She died tragically by suicide, and in the book she's just talking about that depression and how she felt like everyone was trying to just fix it, and she just kept explaining, like, you can't fix me, this is what it is, and I need you to just sympathize. But the way she paints the picture of her mom is her mom just putting her back in these rehabilitation centers, and just the treatments that she underwent were just, it just was dark and heavy. And the song to me was like, if she were still alive and she came to me as a friend and said she was suffering, that was the way I wrote it. It was like as if I was talking to her and saying, like, I hope you find a weakness that you're stronger than, like, I hope you can overcome that. And a lot of it's just me, you know, she talks, this is a little dark, I guess, but she talks about in one of her chapters that, you know, she started cutting herself and stuff. And one of the lines says, you've got a case of winter like no one's ever seen. Is that a new bandage on your knee? So I just picture myself being like this concerned friend, like trying to inquire about the new maybe scars or scratches that I see on my friend. Anyway, that's where the song came from and ended up staying.
Tell me about the Grammy nomination. How, you know, how out of the blue it came, and then what it felt like and what it led to. And it's a wonderful feather in your cap and a kudo at this stage of your life.
Yeah. I'll tell you, I was sleeping on that morning. I think it was a Wednesday morning in November, and I had no idea that the nominations were being revealed, and I don't keep track, honestly. I just like sitting at home with my family on a Sunday and watching the Grammys when it comes around. But truly, if I'm totally honest, I had no idea and didn't expect a nomination until I was probably in my 40s. I mean, do you ever expect it? You don't. Like, you hope that if you ever get it, you know, that you're, I don't know.
Yeah, to the degree that I'm willing to imagine it.
Exactly.
I'm an older human.
There you go. Yeah, thank you.
In that scenario, yes.
Yeah, exactly. This was technically my first debut record under a major label, and it definitely felt like a first statement that I was making, and I just could never have foreseen that, and it was incredible to just be a part of it and to see the way the award ceremony goes down, and also just, it was also, we didn't walk away with an award, but there was a sense of pride and security and like, wow, it that doesn't matter. Like, we already received it. Like, we got a little nod, and that's really what the little award is. It's like, we're everyone there who was nominated, you know, they're winners, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's how I felt about it.
Just to wrap up, tell me about, so it's we're still early in 2020. You've said you've been quite busy, and tell me about what's both exciting and intimidating in the months ahead.
Writing a new record. Mm. It's already a writing cycle, so I'm in that world, and it's so exciting to be there again, because anything is possible, like we were talking about, when it comes to songwriting and arranging and the instrumentation, but the ideas have to be there. And it has to say something. So that's the most intimidating part to me. And then after this little run, I go on tour with Mandy Moore for a little bit, which will be fun. And then the rest of my year is touring here and there, but just writing and getting a record together.
Mm-hmm. Where's your happy place for songwriting?
In my living room, in daylight at home.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In daylight.
Yeah. I really like natural daylight. Like, I have to be by a window.
Right.
Yeah.
Very good. Well, can't wait to see and hear what comes of that.
Thank you.
And Madison, it's just a great joy to meet you.
You too.